This morning, Jeremy spoke about non-linear transition to turbulence in linearly stable hydrodynamic fluids, and that's basically the topic of what I'm going to talk here about, which is our Kepler-like flows, which in the hydrodynamic and stratified approximation are not linearly unstable. Are they turbulent or not? So this is just to remind you of the context. If you take just a small piece of a disk, you can look at it as a straight flow with a constant shear and on which you superimpose some Coriolis force. And that's the basic way to represent either some experiments of rotating planckoid flows or shearing boxes, depending on the way you impose the boundary conditions. Also a number of things need to be said about the form of the Navier-Stokes equation. So there are two terms which are important in the problem, the currents term, and we have added in our codes viscosity term, so that we have basically two dimensionless parameters in the problem: the Reynolds number, usual one, and the rotation number, which is a measure of the Coriolis to the advection term, and it's an inverse Rossby number. But for some reason in this field, in the fluid dynamics community, they always speak about this number. I don't know why. As we are going to look at linearly stable flows, we need to know where the linearly stable domain lies. So if you just re-express something which is Nyquist cyclic frequency type of thing in this language, you find that it's proportional to the rotation number times one plus the rotation number. There is no mystery in that, and you get two different linear stability limits, one where the fluid is not rotating. So rotation number which are positive are linearly stable, correspond to linearly stable flows, and the other stability limit of minus one is the usual constant specific angular momentum stability limit that everyone is familiar with in disk dynamics. So a small definition: when the rotation number is positive, the flow is cyclonic, and when it's negative, the flow is anticyclonic. And this has something to do with contributions to the vorticity of both the shear and the Coriolis force. And Keplerian flow in this language correspond to rotation numbers of what equal to minus four-thirds, so they are in the linearly stable anticyclonic regime. So what's the problem? Let me discuss this very, very quickly. So this is a simulation result for Keplerian flows in a shearing box by Balbus, Hawley, and Winters in 1999. Yes, that's it, 1999. And what they find is basically, whatever the resolution in between 32 cube to 256 cube, deviations from the laminar flow just first are transiently amplified and then decay away to nothingness. On the other hand, a number of people have been emphasizing that in the in fluid mechanical experiments, when you look at linearly stable flows, that is, this is for cyclonic flow, this is for anticyclonic flow, and what is shown here is how the Reynolds number of transition to turbulence evolves when you move away from the marginal stability boundary. Here, the cyclonic one, here, the anticyclonic one. What you see is that you always get transition from laminar to turbulent, except that the Reynolds number requirement increases when you move away from the marginal stability boundary. It can be kind of steep, but nevertheless, you do see the transition. So this raises a number of issues. The first one, which has been asked in the community, is there any problem with resolution and the Reynolds number limitations in the simulations? And the other one, of course, is to which extent the laboratory experiments are relevant to the problem, especially that the boundary conditions are not the same, the aspect ratio are not the same, there are secondary flows like Ekman secretions, etc. So what we did, actually by we, I mean myself and a PhD student of mine, Geoffroy Lesueur, we redid the simulations. So what we did, we chose we made a number of runs, first choosing a resolution, then choosing a Reynolds number, I mean the true one based on the viscous term. And we evolved the flow from marginal stability, from a state in which it is turbulent, and wait until turbulence decays away. So how we do that? We just impose varying rotation number, and we wait for each value of the rotation number long enough so that the flow has time to relax to whatever state it wants to. And there is no little dispute as to when the transition occurs. It's always extremely sharp. What we want to do with that is to characterize the link between rotation and Reynolds number on both linearly stable regimes, both the cyclonic and the anticyclonic one. Sorry? Oh, that's shear times. Shear time scales. It's always shear time scales. And this, well, okay. So that's the basic results I want to discuss. How much time do I have? Okay, I'm halfway through. These are the results for cyclonic flow and anticyclonic flows. So what we have done was to do these simulations with two different types of codes, actually, a finite difference one and a Fourier code. So that's the rotation number, the Reynolds number. We reach pretty high Reynolds number, and I mentioned that before anyone asks how we do that, which is the usual question at this point. And we do find, on the cyclonic side, as in the experiments, that we always have some kind of transition from laminar to turbulent, and that the Reynolds number demand grows, but in a rather regular way, away from the marginal stability boundary. We reached about 0.3 away from the stability boundary. On the anticyclonic side, this similar thing occurs with two major differences. The first one is, well, actually, I've reversed the plot. It's minus the rotation away from the. So it's reversed with respect to the data I showed earlier. Well, anyway. The two major differences which you can see is that it's much more resolution dependent on this side, and also we reach extremely poor rotation numbers, mostly because of the resolution. So actually, there are two different ways you do see the transition on this data, on this numerical data. For example, if you take the 32 cube resolution data, it's a curve like this. Meaning what? Meaning that if you start here and increase, you transit here, for example, and this transition here is basically resolution independent. It's Reynolds dependent and resolution independent. If you increase the Reynolds number, you see exactly the contrary. You begin to transit from turbulent to laminar in a Reynolds independent way, but resolution dependent. That is, if you increase the resolution, this thing moves from here to here. For 64 cube, and from here to here for 128 cube. And you see that the resolution increase depends extremely strongly with the rotation number. I mean, you have to be extremely careful about the way you look at your rotation numbers, otherwise you don't see that the transition depends on the resolution. Okay, so I'm going to zip through that extremely quickly. It's a comparison with experiments. It might sound strange to compare with the experiments because the simulations I showed were made with shearing shear boundary conditions, and they are not in the same boundary conditions as the experiments. But nevertheless, well, green crosses are not a good idea. But anyway, the data I showed earlier for transition to turbulence from laboratory experiments are here, and they do correlate rather well with the transition to turbulence determined numerically for the cyclonic rotation. Actually, there has been also some numerical simulations with rigid boundary conditions. They also, not that we did, somebody else did in the fluid mechanics community, and they do align pretty well with the laboratory data. That's for the cyclonic side. For the anticyclonic side, actually, we get something extremely different. The data by Richard is only. He's the only one to have gathered experimental data on this in this regime. they have a much shallower dependence on the Reynolds number than the numerical data, as you can see. Basically, it grows extremely fast, much faster than in the experiments. So what? Well, I think, I won't have the time to discuss this. You can make an argument that this is because the flow on this side is more perturbed by secondary flows like Ekman secretion than on this side. But it's only an argument, it's no proof. So what next? What we did next was to try to quantify turbulent transport. I'll be done in less than that, I think. So here is something we did, which is to correlate the Reynolds stress, which characterized the transport, with the transition Reynolds number. This is for cyclic rotation, this is for anticyclic rotation, and basically the correlation is the same. It's a correlation that you expect on very simple physical arguments, but nevertheless, we checked that in the data and it works fairly well. Basically, once you're away from the marginal stability, which is here in both cases, it just correlates with the inverse of the transition Reynolds number from laminar to turbulent. So based on this and on some extrapolation of the data I showed earlier on the transition Reynolds number, we've reached the conclusion that the transport in the Keplerian regime, the best you can get is still extremely small compared to what you need in accretion disks. And I think I'm done. Yeah, here is the conclusion. So what? If you want to simulate Keplerian flows, we did estimate with this numerical results that you need resolutions somewhere between 1,000 to 10,000 cube, which is enormous, because you need to also to integrate for thousands of shear times to get something which is statistically significant. The second conclusion is that this Coriolis force does not seem to quench turbulence in linearly stable flows, but obviously does seem to reduce the turbulent transport. And the end result is that our conclusion is that the resulting turbulent transport is way too small for astrophysical purposes. And that's it.
Just on your last point there, you were saying that this hydrodynamic turbulence is too small, but there is also an argument by Bulbus and Hawley that it goes in the wrong direction. So can you tell us about the direction of the angular momentum transport?
Well, there are two arguments by Bulbus and Hawley I'm aware of. One is about convection, it's irrelevant here. And the other one is that if you look at the energetics, that is the energy budgets for the flow, for the component of the velocity in the direction of the flow and the component of the velocity perpendicular to the flow, then in the linearly unstable regime, the thing which correlates with both the shear and the Coriolis force, when it's linearly unstable, it's cooperative, and when it's linearly stable, it's uncooperative. So that's this argument. And they concluded on the basis of this argument that the Coriolis force does quench turbulence. My comment is that we do not see that in the simulations, obviously on the cyclonic side. The argument applies on both sides, actually. It applies the same way on the cyclonic and anti-cyclonic side. And the second conclusion, what was the second conclusion, by the way? I forgot. I had a comment about that, but I forgot. No, I'm not going to mention connection here. It's irrelevant. If it comes back, I'll tell it later.
Okay, Gordon Ogilvie and his student developed this closure model. Can these experiments be interpreted through that, or is it?
I would say
no. Objection to that?
I would say no for two reasons. First, for their favored model, you lose turbulence. What this is about? Yes. So we are talking about a Raynaud stress closure model developed by Garo and Ogilvie. Actually, I think Ogilvie developed it initially for the MRI turbulence, but it's also had some hydro application. Ogilvie, oh, sorry. I have no idea how these nouns are pronounced, I'm sorry. Well, anyway, I know of the paper. I've read it. So for their favorite choice of parameter, you lose turbulence at all Raynaud's number in somewhere here. And their model is symmetric with respect to the rotation number equals to minus half, one half. So it would predict loss of turbulence at about the same place, which on this side, which is at about here. So on this side, I cannot comment because it's off what we did. We didn't reach that much, that high rotation numbers. On this side, obviously, it doesn't work. Another problem with this argument is that it's symmetric. It's symmetric with respect to this rotation number. It's a symmetry which is incompatible with the Navier-Stokes equation. So I think actually it has been proven more than 15 years ago, I think, by Speziale and Maggiore and Muris in a paper in I don't remember which journal. But that's something you can also see. It's a symmetry which is compatible with the linearized form of the Navier-Stokes equation, but it's not compatible with both the Navier-Stokes equation and the continuity equation. If you take both of them, they do not obey this symmetry. And, that's enough maybe on this subject.
Did you start from finite amplitude of perturbation?
Yeah, I forgot to say that. Yes, initially we put white noise with a rather high amplitude.
And did you try different amplitude? This result depends on the initial amplitude of perturbations.
That's a complicated issue. In all subcritical turbulence transitions which have been investigated both in the laboratory and in numerical experiments, it's well known that there is some dispersion in the transition Raynaud's number depending on the initial condition. This dispersion is about factor of 2 in Raynaud's number, and I didn't show it here. It doesn't show in the experiments precisely because this dispersion is extremely reduced if you start with always the same initial conditions. And one way, it was one way to show the resolution dependence. If we had chosen the random the initial conditions, we would have needed to do many, many, many more runs to see something which is statistically significant.
Your calculation were done for a shearing box.
Yeah.
Do you think it would be easier to see transition to turbulence if you had solid boundaries? In other words, could you get closer to the actual experimental setup?
No, actually it's worse. We tried that. The best we can do is reach the same. We tried that fairly extensively on this side because it's easier. But of course you're interested on this side, but I'm going to comment on this one first. Actually, for some reason which is still unclear, when you change the nature of the boundary condition, you have to be much more careful about the aspect ratio of the numerical simulation. And that adds a tremendous lot of leeway in the runs you have to do. And that's much more difficult to pinpoint the case. So you just first do it in the brute way. You don't change the aspect ratio and don't worry about anything. You find the same behavior, but with a much, much higher slope. And there is a very good reason for that, is that, I'm not going to explain. I'll discuss it with you later. But there is a very good reason for that. We tried on this side. If you don't have the right aspect ratio, first you start much higher in Raynaud's number. We have excluded, we're still looking for that. Numerical experiments are still running, but we have excluded with a stupid aspect ratio a transition at 10,000. But we know it's an aspect ratio problem, so we're trying to get get there. And that's for sure that we can, but we need to explore our space ratios much more than that. So, but the basic thing we know is that if you're not careful about the aspect ratio, you always get answers which are higher than what you get here. And also that once you get the correct aspect ratio, you're down to there, but not lower.
I think we've got to cut off this question period now.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Let's thank the speaker again.